Hello, and welcome to season two of the Potential Psychology Podcast. We've been very busy behind the scenes since wrapping up season one, and we have some great expert guests lined up to share their wisdom and experience with you in season two. You'll get to know each guest week by week, and I'd love it if you'd let me know what you've learned, what you've enjoyed, and what you'd like to know more about after each episode. My quest for this season of the podcast is to learn more about you, our smart, savvy listener, so that we can build a really useful and usable collection of resources online and on the air to support you in fulfilling your potential. So drop me an email or say hi via our website. It's at potential.com.au. Today, we're kicking off season two of the Potential Psychology Podcast with episode 11. Hello and welcome to episode 11. Today's guest and I are separated by 13,000 kilometres and the mighty Pacific Ocean, but thanks to the wonders of technology, we're chatting as though we're in the same room. Eileen Lenson is in California, and she's here to talk to us about adversity, resilience, courage, and hope, and her recently published book, Overcoming Adversity, Conquering Life's Challenges. Welcome, Eileen, and congratulations on a wonderful book.
Thank you, Ellen. Thanks for having me on today.
It's lovely. And you are my, well, I shouldn't say quite my first international guest, because I have had someone from our local region on in season one, the lovely Laura Braid. But you are my first US-based guest, which is kind of exciting for a little podcast based here in Australia.
And the first one you've talked to who's in a different day.
Exactly. Yes. That's a bit of a spin out in itself, isn't it? Because I'm having a Friday while you're still having Thursday. So thank you. And I really do appreciate you giving up a bit of your Thursday evening to record this with me. We're going to talk about the book in depth in a moment, because there's some wonderful stuff in there, I think, not only for perhaps listeners who might be dealing with some adversity or challenge in their lives at the moment, but I personally found that reading it, there was a wealth of stuff that I took away just for everyday challenges and things that, you know, just might be a little bit of a curveball or just even those tough days that you have. So I'm going to talk more in depth about that in a moment. But what I'm interested, you gave us a little blurb about your background, and you currently work as a life and business coach, but that's not where you started your career, is it?
Do we ever end up where you start?
No, you don't end up where you start at all. Can you tell us a bit about being a shock trauma social worker and working with traumatologists?
Okay, I have a master's in social work, and yes, I was working in a hospital at the time. And I was not, they didn't even have a trauma social worker position, but I was fascinated. I've always liked to work with people basically when the house is on fire. Mm-hmm. And because I think that we can go in as social workers, as therapists, and provide so much in such a short period of time that impacts so greatly on people for their lives. And so it was a trauma designated hospital, which means that people who sustain more than one or more body injuries, life-threatening injuries to the body parts, are brought there often by helicopter, which means they will even go past a local hospital so they can take the patient to these trauma facilities, because then the traumatologists, who are specially trained surgeons, are there and they can assess the body and they'll say, I can wait, this organ needs to be taken care of. So I convinced the traumatologist that they needed me, and they were very open and agreed to allow me to be on their team with them. It was a real honor. And I would go on rounds with them every week and identify which patients needed my attention the most. A lot of the patients were comatose, a lot of closed head injuries. They didn't need me at that time. Their families did.
Yeah.
Okay. It's the suddenness of it. You know, the loved one left for work that morning, and that's the last they see of them. And then they've sustained these horrific, life-changing situations. Sometimes the patients actually would die after a period of time. So I actually developed a protocol for how to work with these families. It's not the first shock trauma facility, of course, and other and certainly better protocols have been established elsewhere, but I did one for our hospital. And so I was able to work with primarily with the families of the shock trauma patients.
And that, I can imagine, would be a very rewarding experience, but also a very difficult experience for you, personally, there would be things that you have seen and experienced with those families that I can only imagine would have a significant impact on you as well.
I'd say the most difficult part was sometimes the intensive care unit, the waiting room. Family members are sitting there waiting for information, and oftentimes they're not getting it. They're not getting it at the speed they want. Particularly parents of children would be quite devastated, and there'd be a lot of anger in that room. And I had to work it through myself so as to not personalize it and to appreciate that anger and understand how to help them direct it in a way that would help them cope better and get actually the information that they wanted and not alienate the staff.
Yeah, so you really are the middle person there in that situation, aren't you? Trying to be the liaison between the staff in the hospital and those who are attending to, it's clearly a critical emergency, and families who are desperate and distressed and angry and hurt and really, really in a very, very difficult place.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And so you've worked in that particular area for a number of years. Did this play a part in you writing the book, Overcoming Adversity?
Yes, I also worked at the other end of the hospital pretty much with in the neonatal nursery. I worked with fetal demises, and again, it's a tremendous shock to people, and I'd help people learn how to grieve and say goodbye. And sometimes these mothers didn't have much warning at all that they came in expecting to give birth to a full-term healthy baby, and then something went drastically wrong. And giving people the opportunity to, and the tools to know how to say goodbye, the importance of naming the child, because how can you grieve someone that doesn't have a name? Going to the morgue, bringing the baby out, and then helping them to be able to hold the baby, which oftentimes would be protective family members around wanting to protect the mother from hurt and sometimes not wanting me to come see the patient. So yes, that led, that was extremely rewarding. And I spoke internationally on the topic too. And I was very passionate about it, but I moved on and went to another hospital. I feel like I want the whole breadth of everything. I worked at was in the middle of basically a knife and gun battle. And then I went to the other extreme, which was an affluent hospital in Washington, D.C. Actually, when President Reagan was shot, that's where he was taken. And, it's a very high caliber
yes.
hospital. And that was different. I didn't yes. have access to all the patients. Everyone's about to sue. You know, there's this congressman having heart attacks coming into the hospital and having their aides bringing the work over. Like they're not learning anything from this. And so that was really tremendous as well.
Yeah. And that must have been fascinating. I work as a workplace psychologist. So we talk a lot about the culture of different workplaces and the fact that, obviously systems that sit within systems. So there you are in Washington, D.C. with a hospital, which I, from the sounds of things, had a vastly different workplace culture and therefore experience for the staff, experience for yourself, and probably experience for the patients as well.
High level of accountability. I really enjoyed that. But still, it was a teaching hospital, and there was a lot going on. Yeah.
Okay. So after a background in lots of different areas within hospitals, but always working closely with people to help and support them, to care for them and to assist them, you've gone on to write Overcoming Adversity. What was the purpose of the book for you?
You know, I think we all have these sort of nagging questions in our head. And one that's just totally always nagged at me for years is, why do two people who experience a similar type of traumatic event, why does one get stuck? And it seems like life ends for them in many ways. They're resentful, they're victimized, and they're bitter. And someone else will say, you know, I survived that. In fact, I'm glad it happened.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to know, what is it? I've got my clinical skills. I get some of it, but it was bigger than me. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know, I wrote another book. It was a textbook on establishing a private practice in psychotherapy. And that one was so much easier because I was the quote unquote expert. And this book, I wasn't. I was the researcher.
Okay.
And felt like I was going to all ends of the library, so to speak, to gather information. And it was a book that wrote itself. I didn't write it. It told me where to go with it. And some things I knew, some things were validating, and some was just fascinating. So I had to bring in some of the medical, physical, you know, why our bodies are wired a certain way. That's why we're perhaps, our bodies are still wired for that, to run away from that saber-toothed tiger, you know, even though we don't need to anymore. And so if we give into that fear, then it's going to inhibit our ability to work through a major issue that impacts us. And then we'll tend to experience more avoidance. And then that can just be a setup for a series of problems and roadblocks. And that's where people get stuck. But that's why I wrote the book. I like to give the backstory. And okay. People understand my body is working this way. And therefore, I need to understand that it's not something that's wrong with me. It's not shortcoming on my part or something, but rather it's a skill. I'm physiologically built this way and I can overcome it. It will take a little bit of work. It'll take some learning new skills and going down new pathways for me, but that I can persevere by doing this and it's in my interest.
Wonderful. So two things struck me as you were talking about that. One was the experience of writing the book for you in terms of just answering those questions that you had. So really a learning and growing experience for you, I'm guessing, in terms of doing that research, really understanding what we know a lot in psychology. And I know there's a lot of wonderful work with a lot of positive psychologists, which is kind of my area of particular interest that's come out of the book that we'll talk about in a moment. But also, yeah, marrying that up, understanding what is human behavior with individuals' actual experience, those lived experiences that you have seen people, you know, in the moment, noticing, you know, those fear responses, those anxiety responses, and then being able to inform them with some of the knowledge in order to help them pass that. Would that be a summary, I suppose?
Very nicely put. Yeah. Now the book is written for two populations. One, like for therapists who give out
bibliotherapy,
yes, yep. Which I do a lot. I'm always giving information, you know, written information or books to them. And also for that individual who isn't going to go in for therapy or coaching, but is finding themselves getting stuck. Hopefully that book was written, so I wrote it more as on a lay term, you know, as opposed to more academic. I wanted it to be a real tool, just a guidebook.
Yeah, and I think it does that wonderfully. I know when I was reading it, as I said earlier on, you know, I found it even very helpful for me, even though I know a lot of the psychology behind it, you know, just reminders of the simple things that we can do when life gets difficult and when life gets challenging. But you've peppered it with all these wonderful practical examples, some of which are quite distressing, really. You know, these are terribly distressing stories on occasion of families who have lost children, of people who have been significantly injured in combat. You know, it brings the book to life, I think, for the reader. But at the same time, you were able to talk about those things in a really positive way. It's a really positive book.
I approach everything like that.
Great.
Bring me a problem and I'm going to find something in it that we can reframe and use moving forward. And certainly with positive psychology, that, you know, that's very much where we need to go. And that's the tools that people need. And people just impressed me. I'm very honored by the interviews that people gave me. Not one person turned me down and everyone allowed me to use their full name, identify themselves in the book, which I thought was important so that readers wouldn't think that I just made up a story about someone. And I got in a text this week from the one person who has is living with a terminal illness, and he's an attorney and he's really a positive attorney. And I mean, he does coaching as well. And he found it very validating. I don't know how much new he's getting out of it, but he's lived it. And it's very comforting to know that, yes, we're going down that right path.
Yeah.
And for other people to find their way, the gifts in it, the gifts in their loss, you know, such as Major Ed, as you, Polito, who had the, drove over an IED in Iraq. And he was a career military man. It was tremendous loss for him. And he felt suicidal at times. And yet he was able to turn around. One day he said, I felt like someone gave me female blood. He said, because, and he's got some humor. All of a sudden, I started to feel emotions I never felt before. And he liked what he felt.
Wonderful.
And now he goes, he speaks publicly on it a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these people say, I'm glad it happened because I what I learned about myself.
Mm-hmm. So that's one of those, you know, we talk about adversity and we think of it as a negative thing. We think of it as a challenge. We think it as something that could potentially destroy us when we're talking about the sorts of types of adversities that you're discussing in the book. But adversity is not always negative, is it?
In the long run, not always. And that's our job, to use it as a catalyst for maybe re-examining our values, our beliefs, our relationships, an opportunity to discard what's not working for us and focus more on what we've learned is valuable. At first, I think it's such a devastating experience. It's like high, so high on the emotional Richter scale. It's probably off the chart with that. And some people are just absolutely stuck for a while. And that's very understandable and probably, and often not using healthy coping skills. And then they figure out that they need to move forward, that they don't want to stay stuck, that the hurt is too great or the isolation that it's caused. And so they're able to establish improved flexibility, the flexibility to try new things. Then they're able to grow from it and their self-esteem changes. And once they get on that path, it can be a little bit like a snowball. They want to keep going because then the hope steps in. And then they have hope because hope means something's going to change tomorrow if I plan for it and work towards it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that comes across really strongly in the stories that you've told, but also in the model that you use to take people through these phases of understanding their adversity and the skills, because it is very much a skill-based practical book, giving lots of tips and advice and strategies and techniques that people can use, again, for everyday challenges as well as far more significant adversities or losses that they feel experience in their life. Can you talk us through the five components to overcoming adversity, and then there's three spheres of social support, isn't there?
Yes. I've identified five components that we need to work through that help us work through an adversity. I'll just talk a little bit about...
Yeah, list them all and then we can talk a little bit about each one.
Forgiveness, courage, perspective taking, perseverance, and then hope. And forgiveness is often misunderstood by people initially. They think that it's about letting bygones be bygones towards an offender or denying basically that it happened, or forgiving in a time frame that works for everyone else but not for them. But rather, forgiveness is about the ability to take your power back, to take control again of your emotions and not let anger escalate. Anger is a healthy emotion, but when it gets to the point where we're not allowed to, we lose the ability to experience positive emotions, then it's going to really destroy us. And if we stay unforgiving towards an offender, then we stay connected with that person. And we have to be careful because we can actually end up becoming like that person.
Yeah. And I found that interesting when I was reading the book, because I think that idea, you know, if somebody has harmed one of our loved ones, for example, and we quite naturally, I would think, you know, notions of revenge and notions of punishment and really wanting that person to suffer in the way that we are suffering, I think is a natural first response. But you're right, and you illustrate in the book that if we hang on to that, that is terribly destructive in the long run. And I love that idea that we need to be able to take our power back and not remain connected to that person. You do occasionally read stories of people who have been able to forgive, you know, the most monstrous circumstances or offences that people have conducted against a family member or a loved one, and yet they're able to disconnect from that. And I think that came across really powerfully in the book.
But I also think that people have to understand that the timing is theirs. And it's their choice to forgive, that there's no expectation. And I think everyone's forgiveness looks different. Like one mother in my book, her daughter, 5-year-old daughter, was murdered. And she had all of those emotions that you talked about. She would lie in bed plotting revenge, what she wanted to do to the perpetrator. And then one day, and it was destroying her, one day she realized it didn't happen to me. It happened to my daughter. And that is when she started to take her power back. And understanding who that person was that murdered her child, that coming from the horrible upbringing that he had, how could one have ever expected him to be anything other than a hateful monster as an adult? And so that understanding helped her. And then she took that energy and turned it into positive and started a program in the community. And she said, that will help children in a way I wasn't able to help my child. And she even has a joy in it. And she says, I have the luxury of being able to talk about my daughter all the time. So she's redefined that relationship with her daughter. And as a parent, feeling that you couldn't protect your child, she's feeling like she can do something in her child's name and honoring others. And so she demonstrated excellent coping strategies, and it took her years to get there.
Yeah, so that time frame is going to be different for everyone. It's an individual experience. And I suppose for some people, perhaps thinking about these concepts, they might think, well, you know, I should get on with this forgiveness part. I should be getting to that. But I suppose part of it is understanding that if we know and we develop these coping skills, and if we read your book, then, you know, that time will come for us when that time is right.
And actually what you say is interesting, because a lot of times the comment of, well, get on with it, is coming from other people around us. And so that's very, very important to make sure that we surround ourselves with people who are not toxic, or are going to be supportive and helpful. We cannot get over it on someone else's time frame. There is no time frame.
Yeah. And I'm thinking now, and it didn't strike me while I was reading the book itself, but just talking about that, you know, this not only is a useful book for all of us and those overcoming adversity themselves, but for their loved ones too, for a bit of insight into what they might be experiencing and the process that they'll go through.
Yes. And the individual is going through it often doesn't have that energy to educate others in terms of what they need.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I have had to do that with people that I've worked with to help them. It's really developing a compassion for the others in their sphere, you know, and empathizing with them in terms of what they're going through.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a tool for helping them to do that. So that's forgiveness. The second of these components is courage.
All right. Courage is really important, because courage strengthens our ability to keep going forward and to try new things and to start the healing process. And so that's really important. Through courage, we develop, can start to develop positive emotions and feelings. And that's very important going forward.
And can you give us an example, perhaps from the book, of someone who showed particular courage?
Yes. An Italian gentleman, extremely wealthy, successful, man. He was vacationing in Antigua, I think it was, and he was notified that he was going to be arrested by the Italian government when he went back because they were accusing him of tax evasion. So he decided to return, but on his own terms so that they wouldn't be able to display him for their political purposes, went back and they incarcerated him. He, social class wise, this is someone who I think, I can't remember how many, like 60,000 employees maybe used to have, he was used to being in charge of other people, not surrendering every bit of his control of his day up. And yet he went into prison and he decided that he would learn, why not? While I have to be here, I might as well learn Chinese. I wanted to learn Chinese. And I said, why? You could have had so many different reactions. Why that one? And he said, well, I heard my grandparents talk about World War One. I heard my parents talk about World War Two. And so I decided that why should life be any different for me? Why should I not be exposed to adversity? And so that gave him the courage to not only more than endure his days in the prison because he took advantage of it. And he said he did very well in learning Chinese, but he learned about other people in prison and their experiences in life. And it cost him a tremendous amount of money, but he fought his case and was found to be innocent. And he came out and he said, you know what? I found I was tested and I really liked who I am and how I conducted myself. And he says, and I'm glad it happened, you know? And so that took a lot of courage to go through with that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And so interesting. I know in psychology, post-traumatic stress is quite a well-known phenomenon and experience for people who have had, significant adversity. But there's increasing research around the notion of post-traumatic growth now, that some people, and it's very much in tune with what you're talking about and some of these examples that you give in the book of people who have experienced this, and because they've been able to implement these different components or really take hold of these different components that you talk about in this example, courage, and grow from it rather than be destroyed by it.
Yeah, we all come into a situation with adversity with our individual life histories. And they have to do with different values and beliefs we have about the world and ourselves and our culture. And sometimes some of those beliefs are helpful and some aren't so helpful. And when we have that crossroad with adversity, it's an opportunity to examine some of those beliefs and practices that we have and decide which ones we're going to shed. And one woman I know in particular that I felt like you were speaking to about her, to her, was I had gone through a divorce and husband divorced her. He left her. She was devastated. And then she was able to examine her core beliefs and she saw which ones weren't working, which ones had caused her problems in the past. And she did the hard work of, and showed courage in being able to face some aspects of herself that were painful. But she got through it, got to the other side, which is, a therapist or a coach, we know that if someone will push through, the sun shines on the other side. But it takes that courage to go through. But it was very empowering. And she could never go back now to being the person she was before. And she says, I don't want to experience that pain again. And yet, I wouldn't be the person I am today without it.
Mm, I'm actually a better person and potentially a happier person, from the sounds of things, a happier person as a result of that experience.
He's more authentic.
Mm-hmm. So that's courage. And I think there was a little bit of perspective taking in that example as well. That's the next component of the model, isn't it? Perspective taking.
But you're right. They do bleed over a little bit. Forgiveness pops itself up. Hope comes in, different ones. Perspective taking. Typically, when we are in a crisis, our vision narrows. Certainly, we need to do that immediately in a crisis. That helps us to survive. Our pupils get big. Again, you got the physiological part going on. But we have to be careful. If we isolate ourselves too much, then we're not getting in new ideas. If we're overwhelmed by the adversity and we've cut ourselves off from our social ties, then we're not getting information, suggestions on different ways that we could look at things. And so perspective taking helps us a lot in terms of developing an understanding of others. And it promotes positive feelings inside of us, which again, we need in order to forge ahead and become resilient individuals. It helps us also to understand a little bit more about the situation, that situation or offender that injured us.
Okay, so it's a little bit of kind of stepping out of ourselves at that point that we're ready and able to do that, because as you say, you know, there's this physiological response that is a self-protective mechanism to kind of narrow our thoughts and feelings to keep us safe, but recognizing, I guess, that stops helping us at a certain point, and being able to step perhaps a little away from ourselves and that narrow perspective to look at the situation from different perspectives to help us cope and then grow.
Yes. And if we maintain that narrow perspective, we're likely to just ruminate mm-hmm. about the situation. It causes us to be backward oriented, to just be focusing on the situation and rehashing it over and over in our minds, as opposed to looking forward at what can we do to bring more happiness and contentment to our lives.
Yeah, and it's very much aligned with Barbara Fredrickson's broaden and build model in positive psychology, the experience of being able to experience positive emotion that then allows our openness to new ideas, our creativity, and obviously our perspective taking as well. So what are some of the practical tips that you give? Because I know you give a series of practical tips to help people in each stage of the book as they read through these components, implement it in their own lives. What are some of the practical exercises that you, or tips that you give to people to enhance their perspective taking?
One thing that one can do on their own is work on rewriting the ends of their sentences. So if one's perspective tends to be somewhat negative about an individual or situation, add on the end something different, something positive. Focus on the positive. There's always something that there's some balance to whatever that situation is. And so that keeps our heads from going into like that negative spiral. And because then we sort of end up where we're looking at. That's why we get directions about like going to the mall. Otherwise, we wouldn't know how to go. And so if we keep talking negatively, that's where we're going to go. And our perspective will stay stilted in that way. Another is maybe asking, using society, using our community, asking for others for their perspective on the situation and how you are viewing it. And so enjoy the wealth of different angles. Maybe sit down with a piece of paper and write, if you're talking about the event is about someone else, write down your ideas from their perspective, how they would view it differently.
Okay. So almost sort of, again, trying to step outside of ourselves perhaps and imagine, you know, if I was somebody else thinking about this situation, how might they handle it? Or if I was a good friend who I know has coped with adversity, how did they handle it? Is there a different way of thinking about this situation?
Yes, exactly.
Perfect. Lovely. Okay. So that's perspective taking. Perseverance is the next of these components. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yep. Perseverance is the refusal to give up, even when obstacles are encountered. Instead, one examines it, learns from it, and then figures out how to reevaluate it and move forward.
Okay.
Because going through it, adversity, no matter what your plan is, there's going to be multiple unforeseen barriers.
And this is something that I know I do a lot of, even just in coaching people in a very practical sense, but when you're trying to achieve a goal, anticipating at times what the obstacles are. So actually thinking through what might be some of the obstacles that I'm going to face in trying to achieve this goal, and then starting to brainstorm and look at how are the different ways that I might overcome those obstacles in order to keep going.
Yes. That's the grit in people. The, I'm not going to stop. I've got this goal and I want to accomplish it.
And I'm going to persevere. So in these examples that you give in the book, these are people who have been able to successfully see that there is some sort of light at the tunnel, that life won't necessarily look or can't look as it used to, but it does go on and there is an opportunity to still emerge from this experience, a, if not happier person, at least a reasonably content person.
Yeah, finding value in other ways. And a lot of that is in re-examining values and finding meaning and a sense of purpose. I think that's what we need in order to find resiliency.
Yeah, and another wonderful example from positive psychology. I know all of these areas, this is one of the things that really excited me when I looked at the book, was these notions of perspective taping, of forgiveness, of courage, of hope, are all areas that positive psychology researchers have been delving into in order to understand what helps people to thrive and flourish. So being able to really adapt those to situations of adversity, I think has been, you know, you've come up with some wonderful examples of that in the book.
Thank you. Now, hope is that last one. Hope is a biggie. I think without hope, you couldn't move through any of those stages at all. Hope is what keeps us going. And hope has a whole lot of spiritual undertones to us, because hope is basically the keep on keeping on type of thing. And but it's different than a lot of people think when they say, oh, I hope I win the lottery. Okay, that has no plan. Okay, that's like counting on something, just being passive and hoping that good things happen to you. Hope is actually a very driven, purposeful path to take, which there's a goal and there's plans on how to achieve that goal. And the with the recognition that goals may need to change as we learn things along the way, or if there's barriers that can't be overcome, or some of the pathways may need to be changed.
And this comes from Rick Snyder's work in Hope, is that right? Because that was one of the things that really excited me when I started reading about hope as a concept, as a psychological concept, as opposed to perhaps, as you were just explaining, the layperson's understanding of hope as just being something that we are completely passive about. And if, you know, if we wish it enough, then it will happen. So this psychological notion of hope is more that we have a goal or a future that we look forward to, and then we start to uncover what are the pathways in order for me to get to those goals? What are the steps that I need to take in order for me to actually get to this point that I'm looking to get to?
And hope has a whole lot of, I'm not giving up in it. Hope has a lot of, in fact, the spiritual part is, I think for hope is, it's intangible. And that's what spirituality is. And it's just the belief that there's something bigger than this, bigger than me, bigger than this situation, and I'm going to go towards it.
Yeah, I love that, bigger than this situation. So this is not the whole of me. This is, you know, life is more than this set of circumstances that I'm dealing with at the moment. And I can imagine that that would be a very hopeful place to be, having that realization that, you know, there's more to life than just what I'm going through right now.
Yeah, it takes a lot of courage to keep at that.
Yeah, so we're tying up the hope with courage, with perseverance. All of these sorts of pieces come together in this lovely holistic model. So that's the, I suppose, the personal things that people can do to deal with adversity is actually starting to cultivate these notions of forgiveness, courage, perspective taking, perseverance and hope. And you give lots of not only lovely examples, but tips and tools and strategies for people to be able to do that in the book. The second side is more of the social sphere of it, this support sphere.
So we have all this information about what we ought to do, what we have to watch out for, why we're behaving the way we are. But that wouldn't be enough. How do we accomplish that? Well, there's three spheres of support that are really the secret sauce in enabling those other us to go through those and accomplish those five components of overcoming adversity. And it's what I call the three S's: self, society, and spirituality. The self is everything like within us. It's what we come to the party with. So part of it could be our personality. And it's like our DNA is basically given to us, but it's how our brain can reprogram that very much based on the experiences we have. And so, for instance, if we are in terms of a personality type, tend to be maybe a little neurotic, you know, to always worrying about things, sort of negative, pessimistic type of person, we're probably born that way. That is who we are. However, we can also recognize that there's things that we can do so that we can make sure that we're adding in positive components and challenging our negative beliefs so that we don't let that become a barrier. There's the individual things like within us. Self-esteem is very critical. It's really hard to go through any of this with a low self-esteem. The next part, the source of support, is society. Society is pretty much everything outside of us. Any of the institutions that we engage in, our families, relatives, everyone. And they are instrumental. In fact, they're usually our first responders when we experience adversity. And they make our landing softer for us. They help us by, they improve our self-esteem. They help reassure us of our strengths, who we were before this injury, as well as providing resources, either concrete resources, like after a tsunami that was very powerful to some people, or the emotional support or information about things out there. It could be self-help groups, could be therapy. But that helps keep pathways open for us, our social support. And that's the problem. When our perspective gets narrowed, we're often cutting out the social component.
Yeah. And that's interpersonal connectedness is so important to our well-being. I often say that, you know, even the most introverted of us are still, you know, humans are social animals. We need to have that communication, that connection with other people to remain healthy and well and happy. And I can imagine that that is, you know, tenfold, if not hundredfold, when it comes to dealing with really difficult circumstances in life.
Well, I agree with you so much on that. You know, we came into life because of a social interaction. And we're experiencing all that through our lives. And we have these mirror neurons that when we connect with someone, we start to really connect. It brings out positiveness in us. And so, yes, we need others for our survival.
And I guess, too, there's a little bit of, you know, to some extent, being a little bit selective, you know, for somebody who is dealing with a very set of difficult circumstances in their lives, and even sometimes perhaps everyday challenges, that being a little selective about those people that we do spend time with is going to be important, because there will be people in our lives who are not particularly good at being positive or not always as good as being supportive as perhaps we'd like. So, you know, picking the positive people, would that be part of the strategy?
Positive/healthy. Yes. Other people they can give us their best suggestions and advice, but it's based on their history, and it may not be healthy for us to surround ourselves with that. But then sometimes that support system can mean the difference between succeeding and not. So people who are going against like political tyranny, if they didn't have that type of support for them, it would be nearly impossible for them, because they face ostracism and threats.
Yeah.
But yes, we have to be careful about people's agendas and their intent. Yeah. So it's not blanketly everyone is a good support system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what's the third sphere?
Spirituality.
Okay.
It is sometimes misunderstood because people think it's about religion. And whereas religion is founded on spirituality, religion has the structure, has rules and a belief system, where spirituality is, as we said before, it's a belief in something greater than us. And one need not be religious to experience spirituality. But that can really help provide a tremendous motivator in us to be able to continue going forward.
Mm. It's very much that sense of meaning and purpose in life, isn't it? Which I always think of the best explanation that has been most meaningful to me is being contributing to something that's larger than ourselves. So yeah. Finding those things in our lives that, and that can be as simple as, you know, where I live, we have Australian football. And it's a very important part of the culture in regional cities, in particular where I am. And a lot of people are very actively involved just in their football club. And I think that gives them social support, it gives them contact, it gives them connection, but it also does give them that sense of contributing to something that's larger themselves, a sense of belonging, a bit of purpose. You know, why do I get up in the morning? Well, you know, even if I'm struggling, people rely on me to go and, you know, contribute in this way, to umpire or to work in the canteen, or, you know, even very practical things like that, that we might not think of as being spiritual, but certainly can contribute to a sense of meaning and purpose that might get somebody through if they're dealing with a difficult even day, perhaps.
You know, you're right. Spirituality is just, it's a thread that goes through so much. And you talked about being involved in the football games. Yes, having a role provides us with a sense of purpose. It can sometimes get people going and keep them from going to a very dark place. Mm-hmm. It gives meaning. And belonging to a group of people is vital. Laughter.
Yes.
I think you were addressing that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Laughter is very connective with other people. And that sense of belonging, and therefore you're not feeling so alone. And that's what all this is looking at. The resources we have within and the resources without. And that provides us with the strength to keep going forward.
Yeah. That's a lovely way to round it off, really, isn't it? That some of these things seem perhaps conceptually difficult when we think about courage and hope and these big ideas, but what you're able to convey in the book and just in having this conversation is that some of the actual strategies that you can use to cultivate these things, cultivate courage and hope and perspective taking, can be as simple as just connecting with another person and having a laugh.
Yeah, I'm a really practical person. Derek, you could probably see that in the book. And I say, okay, just don't tell me. Tell me, how can I use these tools? And that's why it is. It's simply really a tool guide for people.
It's a practical guidebook for getting through difficult experiences, big and small.
Yes. And the beauty of using them, even for the small ones, is that then we learn new skills. We have a new skill set. That if we have a larger event happen later on, we will already be empowered because we have that knowledge as a resource to ourselves.
Yeah, what a great tip. It's almost a preventative strategy. You know, read the book and use this in everyday life because it really is very much applicable in everyday life. And then it will hopefully skill you up for, you know, should things get more difficult down the track, which of course we hope doesn't, but that is life, isn't it?
It's going to, 100% of us are going to experience adversity, but not everyone is going to deal with it well because we just don't have that skill set going into it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Providing them with the skill set in order to do that, to tool us up as best as possible to deal with life's challenges.
That was my goal.
Wonderful. I think you've really achieved it well, Eileen. Again, I congratulate you on the book, and there's 1,000 other things that we could talk about, I think, today, but we might leave it there. Where can people, the book itself is published by Australian Academic Press, and I know that it's available via all the certainly online bookstores because I've checked and I've seen it there. Where else can people find you online if they'd like to learn a little bit more about you and the other work that you do?
Well, first of all, I'm glad you pointed out my Australian connection.
Yeah.
How did you get an Australian publisher? So I'm very happy there. Oh, and so through my website, which is lensonlifecoaching.com.
And you also do some writing for Thrive Global. Is that true? Yep. Okay, so I will link to some of those articles and your website in the show notes for this episode, and I will make sure that we have your other contact details and obviously some links to the book and where people can find it. So look, Eileen, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate it. As I said, I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I took a lot away from it myself. I have no doubt that listeners will as well, should they choose to seek it out. And I think, you know, being able to encapsulate so much of what positive psychology has to offer from your own personal experience and professional experience, and depth of just having worked with so many people struggling through these experiences, it does come off across in a lovely practical way that I think is making a significant contribution to helping people deal with and overcome and emerge positively from adversity.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the kind words and the interview. Ellen, it's been delightful sharing this with you. Thank you.
I'm glad. I've thoroughly enjoyed it too. And thank you very much for your time. If you'd like to know more about Eileen, her work, and her tips for emerging positively from adversity, we've put together a guest profile sheet on the Potential Psychology website. Pop over to potential.com.au/podcast. Eileen's book, Overcoming Adversity, Conquering Life's Challenges, is available via all good bookstores, both online and bricks and mortar. You may also find a copy at your local library. I've checked the catalogue at my local library and it's on the shelf there. And I'm loving the local library at the moment, both as a source of many of the great books written and recommended by our podcast guests, but also as a great workspace. If you follow my Instagram stories, you'll often find me mixing up the scenery to maintain my work inspiration, and our local library is a popular workplace choice for me right now. Coming up in our next episode, I'm talking to a kindred spirit in James Garrett, a fellow positive and workplace psychologist who specialises in understanding and using the power of your mind to enhance your productivity and your well-being. Want to know how to harness your attention to stay focused, work in sprints and breaks to maximise your efficiency, and understand the nitty-gritty of motivation? We cover all of that and more in the next episode. Here's a sneak peek.
We've now learned that the brain is deeply sensitive to experience, and so you'll wake up with a different brain tomorrow than you had today just based on how much the brain is constantly changing. And so get in the driver's seat of that process.
That's James Garrett in the next episode of the Potential Psychology Podcast. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.